I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm very excited to talk about this work. This is work that's gone in some surprising directions. The most frequent, the most recent version is work with Stefan Alexander, who's a professor at Brown University in cosmology, the student Robert Sims, and Zhao Mugwezhou, who is a cosmologist in Imperial College. But that's only the most recent step in what's been a many-year process to investigate several mysteries having to do with the cosmological constant in the context of what sometimes or used to be called loop quantum gravity. Although nothing explicitly in this talk has to do with loop quantum gravity, it's inspired by mathematical structures which poke their head up and intrigued us and continue to intrigue me from the early days of loop quantum gravity. So this is work in progress. It also, in the beginning, I'll have to catch people up on work from the 1990s with Chokin Su. And then if I get a chance, there are several iterations of the work in the beginning. I don't have to pontificate about the profoundness of the cosmological constant problem, so I'll leave that to other people. And I want to make it clear that the actual results that I'm going to talk about today are mostly classical or semi-classical. So the first question will be, how do you address the real cosmological constant problem? And my answer will be, we're thinking about it. So I want to emphasize that this is not a solution to the problem of what happens to all the vacuum energy of all the quanta in the universe and how come they don't have weight. But we have done something pretty nifty and pretty surprising to me, and it would be fun to introduce it to you. Now, I use the word natural, and I use the word natural deliberately to be provocative. We have Sabina Hossenfelder's book about loss in math attacking us theoretical physicists for our use of the word natural and the concept of naturality. So what I mean by natural is this is an extension of general relativity which gives dynamics to the cosmological constant, which has no free parameters. That's the first thing I mean by natural. And in which the dynamics is particularly minimal. And what I mean by the dynamics being particularly minimal is that we're going to give dynamics to the cosmological constant through a topological term, through the addition to general relativity of a topological interaction or a topological term. But when we dream of making the cosmological constant non-constant, that topological term will give dynamics and tell the cosmological constant how to evolve. This is very much in the spirit of what's really a central theme in quantum gravity, which is the understanding that the dynamics of general relativity are very close to those of a topological field theory. In 2+1 dimensions, general relativity is a topological quantum field theory. And in 3+1 dimensions, classical general relativity is essentially a topological field theory plus some quadratic constraint equation. And this extension of the theory to give dynamics to the cosmological constant is that theme of staying close, staying just sort of epsilon away or on the boundary of topological field theory. It's also in line with something which has been a theme of my work several different ways, several different projects, which is that if we have a mystery about the value of a coupling constant in nature, we should stop trying to solve the problem and give the constant the means to solve its own problem. That is, give it dynamics. And then the constant will solve the problem of how it sets its value for us, rather than having to invent fake profound principles like the anthropic principle or something like that. The principle is you don't understand why a constant has such a small or big or unnatural value, then give it some dynamics and let it fend for itself. And we'll see that that has an interesting outcome. Now, there's another theme that goes back to the early days of the investigations of loop quantum gravity and is also related to twister theory and several other studies in relativistic physics. And that's what I call the hidden chirality of general relativity. General relativity is, of course, not a chiral interaction. Gravity is parity even. But there are indications, very strong and very provocative indications, that general relativity has underlying it a hidden chiral structure, a hidden preference for one-handedness over the other-handedness. And I'm not going to review these because these are easy to find if you don't know them, if you know the buzzwords to look at. But the basic clue is that the dynamics of general relativity, which Einstein wrote as an infinite order theory, that is, it's infinite order in the metric variable and its derivative, reduces in the Plobansky formalism to a cubic action, an action which is purely cubic in its dynamical variables, with no inverse, no G inverse, no determinant, just purely cubic in dynamical variables, which I'll remind you is the simplest nonlinear action that you can have, because then the equations of motion are quadratic equations, which is the only thing which is one step more complicated than linear. So when we reduce general relativity to a theory with quadratic equations of motion and cubic action, we're reducing it to the simplest possible form. And to do that, you have to be chiral. You have to do that in a way that prefers the left-handed connection and left-handed structures over right-handed structures. And that, many of us feel, is a huge hint as to the structure, the deep structure of gravity. Another thing which is closely related to that is twister theory, where you discover in the complexification of Lorentzian spacetime a beautiful complex geometry, which is chiral, which treats left-handed polarizations different than right-handed polarizations. And these are both related ultimately to this closeness, to this being on the boundary of topological field theory. So it's been natural to ask, since these structures became apparent, and the Plobansky formalism, and I will introduce it for those of you who don't know it, was written down by Plobansky in the middle, early 70s. Twister theory was already well under development, so these are things that go back. And because nobody read Plobansky's paper, it had to be reinvented by Capovia, Dell, and Jacobson, who were early 90s. So in the middle 90s, many of us were wondering, might this hidden chirality manifest itself in quantum gravity? Might quantum gravity have chiral parity asymmetric manifestation? And this is very important for experiment because it's so hard to get to the Planck scale. There's so much noise between us and the Planck scale. But if there's a protected channel, it might be that we could observe Planck scale physics. And something like chirality could act as a protected channel to make chiral or parity breaking physics evident. And an example of that, which we worked on with Carlo Cantaldi and Giao Miguezio, and other people worked on it as well, is parity odd observables in the CMB. And there's a huge opportunity, we feel, in investigating parity odd observables in the CMB, like T, like temperature B parity fields mixing and correlation. There's also those of us who have studied the phenomenology of quantum gravity and looked at relative locality or doubly special relativity or breaking Lorentz invariants, which show themselves up in modifications of the dispersion relations of the energy momentum relation, are sensitive to the role of parity breaking, parity odd modifications of the dispersion relation to the photon. So there is a literature, it's not huge, but there's a literature about searching for parity on signals having to do with quantum gravity. And here we find a whopping one, if it's true. So the punchline, I'm giving you the punchline of the whole talk, by the way, that's an equation for the cosmological constant over 3, which is, of course, if you're to consider the square root of the Hubble parameter, in terms of the anomaly in the conservation of the chiral left-hand current of fermions. And there are some numbers there, like 16 pi squared and 3. And those are all that I'm not hiding any Planck lengths or Newton's constants or h bar. Though both left and right side of that equation have dimensions of 1 over length squared, naturally. So that's a very provocative relationship. And I will derive it in the course of this talk. Plus, because of this dynamics, cosmological constant, as I'll show in our dynamics, sometimes goes right to that value and just stays there. Of course, that redshifts away, which means that the cosmological constant redshifts away. But we find other solutions from other initial conditions where the cosmological, and I'll be showing you some numerical integrations of the theory that I'm discussing, and you'll see that some solutions go right to that fixed point and sit there, and others oscillate around it. And others have the cosmological constant freeze out at a larger at another value, which eventually dominates the energy density. But this is all just a preview for what's coming at the end. But that is, of course, a chiral observable, so I really mean there's an absolute value inside that square root. And where the reason why I'm talking about this, you'll see this is a semi-classical relation. There are lots of things we don't know about it, but we have an argument for it based on a semi-classical extension of general relativity that I'll be telling you about in a few minutes. And we're kind of excited about that. So everything that I want to tell you about started with Chopin Hsu in 1993, 1994, by thinking about the problem of time in classical quantum gravity. And I've worked a lot on the problem of time in classical quantum gravity. But here I'm not posing anything profound. I'm using an old tradition in general relativity, which is that there should be clocks if you either using physical conditions or gauge conditions, slice space-time into a sequence of spatial slices, you can attribute clocks to those spatial slices which are functions of the dynamical degrees of freedom. And that is an old tradition in classical general relativity of such intrinsic time. For example, the trace of the extrinsic curvature, if you let me abuse language, is such an intrinsic time as a function of the gravitational degrees of freedom. And there's one which is, we think, is very interesting to contemplate, and I'll be introducing it in a minute, which is related to the Chern-Simons invariant of the Ashtekar connection, or if you don't know what the Ashtekar connection is, the left-handed projection of the space-time connection. And if you don't know what the Chern-Simons invariant is, I'll be introducing it shortly. So the Ashtekar variables are key to this simplification of general relativity from the way that Einstein wrote it, with infinite order derivatives and inverses and determinants and simple quadratic equations. And it's a complex variable. It is the projection into the three-dimensional slices of the left-handed part of the space-time connection. And it has a real part and an imaginary part. I actually don't know if this has a... Let's see. Yeah. And the real part is the three-dimensional spin connection, and the imaginary part is the extrinsic curvature, essentially, which is also code for the time derivative of the free metric, which is also code for the momentum. All of this is modulo various factors. of the three metric. So this object fails to commute with the three metric, and the Poisson brackets of this object, this connection, and the frame fields made from the metric are the fundamental Poisson brackets of the theory, as you see here. E are the various components of the frame field, and A is the components of this connection. And the Poisson bracket yields an I constant and a bunch of and now I'm not going to review, I've got lots to say, I'm not going to review the whole dynamics of general relativity, but it's a system which has, can be written, where the action can be written in the form of momentum configuration dot. So we take the connections as the configuration variables and not the metrics. Metrics are momentum variables. And doing this flip and taking the connection as the configuration variables is the key point to that simplification I talked about, and also the key way that chirality, the similar chirality enters. And then there are some constraints. The constraints generate refoliations of the three surfaces, diffeomorphisms of the three surfaces, gauge transformations of the connection. And they're all nice and first class. And they're simple cubic equations. Nowhere am I hiding a determinant or a square root or an inverse. This is not just simpler than the Wheeler-DeWitt equation or the ADM language. It's infinitely simpler, which is why people were able to make progress. Now, I want to point to a particular class of solutions to the classical constraint equations of general relativity. These are those where the F, and sometimes I use F and sometimes I use R, and I'll apologize for it. Sometimes I use three-dimensional indices to represent the chiral left-handed SC2, and sometimes I use Skinner indices. And again, I won't apologize for going between them. If somebody is confused by my indices, ask a question. I want to communicate the key ideas and the key results, not the messy details. So this is where the left-handed part of the space-time connection is equal to a frame field times minus the cosmological constant over 3. And this is a very special class of phase-space configuration. And they're called self-dual configurations. And of particular interest is that these include de Sitter and anti-de Sitter for the appropriate signs of the cosmological constant. And for we consider both the Lorentzian case and the Euclidean case. The Euclidean case, it includes a lot more. It includes a whole menagerie of gravitational instantons, which may be very interesting and have been studied. So keep your eye on these self-dual solutions, which you can find out just by eyeballing the cubic equations of the constraints and the equations of motion solve the theory. Well, this is just really propaganda that I've been saying. So let me go ahead. Because I'm going to come back at the end of the talk and be doing numerical integrations and generalizing De Sitter space-time and Friedman-Robinson-Walker space-time, let me just tell you how De Sitter space-time is coded into this language. If we use a homogeneous solution like De Sitter, the Ashikar variable, again, is a connection whose real component is the three-dimensional spin connection, which I'm going to choose a flat slicing, so that's 0, plus the time derivative of the frame field, or the time derivative of the metric times I. So we take as an ansatz that A is diagonal in some gauge times the square root of lambda over 3 times some function of time, compute the curvature tensor, use the self-dual conditions to compute the frame field and the metric, and then we plug this into the equations of motion. We have to fix one gauge by fixing what the lapse is, and we fix the lapse according to its density weight. And lo and behold, we get to see the space. I did that a little fast, but it's enough to see that it's absolutely simple and straightforward to represent the Sitter space-time in these variables, which is going to be useful for me as I go along. Now, here's something very, the Chern-Simons invariant is a mathematical object that was invented for three-dimensional, for gauge theories on three-dimensional space-time, so three-dimensional manifolds, for reasons of topologies. And here it's going to come in an amazing way in classical general relativity. And so I'm going to use Hamilton-Jacobi theory to solve general relativity. When you use Hamilton-Jacobi theory, you invent a Hamilton-Jacobi function, a scalar function on configurations, which are connections or gauge fields, such that its derivative is the momentum, the canonical momentum. Remember, the E's are canonical momentum for the connections. But if I use the self-dual condition, the E's are proportional to the F's. So the gradient of the Hamilton-Jacobi function up to some constants is the curvature F. But that has a unique solution. The unique scalar function of a gauge field whose gradient is the curvature is the Chern-Simons invariant. The Chern-Simons invariant is the integral over a three manifold, and I'm going to always take that to be compact, of a three form Y Chern-Simon, which is the trace of A wedge dA plus two-thirds A cubed. And that's one of its amazing properties, and we'll be using several other of its amazing properties. So Mr. De Sitter and Mr. Anti-De Sitter and all these other people who played with geometry didn't realize that there was this beautiful structure from three-dimensional topology playing the role of the Hamilton-Jacobi function in solving general relativity and revealing these cosmological solutions. But it's absolutely central. And that is intriguing if you remember the close relationship between general relativity and topological field theory. It was then natural, and the first person who did this was Hideo Kodama, to take this Hamilton-Jacobi function and exponentiate it and make a semi-classical state of the gravitational field. So that's called the Kodama state. And I want you to notice that it has a coefficient 2 over 3 times the cosmological constant. So it comes in with a 1 over the cosmological constant. And if you're really clever and disconnect at this point, you can take that clue and in 10 minutes invent for yourself the rest of my talk. The rest of my talk is just consequences of the fact that that's 1 over the cosmological constant. Yeah?
So, given that the Chern-Simons form doesn't have reasonable positivity properties, what is that purely in?
That's a very interesting question, and if I get to it by the end, I'm going to tell you that it's a transition amplitude, it's not a state. And the worry that it does, that it's not normalizable under the physical inner product, while never resolved, is not relevant for its correct use. This is as a transition amplitude and not as a Bra stator. But in any case, there was a lot of work done studying this. And one of the things that is interesting, as a semi-classical state, it makes perfect sense, the exponential of a Hamilton-Jacobi function. So we all know how to work with it at the semi-classical level and compute the determinant that sits in front of it and do semi-classical physics with it. And it works completely well for a semi-classical description of physics, for example, in considered space-time. But it happened possibly as an accident to solve the exact quantum constraints of the theory. And there is a whole discussion in the literature about that going on years, and what I have to say is nothing to address that. So I'm not addressing that issue. I'm just pointing out to you its use as a Hamilton-Jacobi function in a semi-classical state. I do want to mention one intriguing thing, which is that if you take the, what we call the loop transform of that functional that is represented as a wave function in loop quantum gravity as a function of spin network graphs, then the integral you have to do has this form where T is the traces of the holonomies around the various edges of the spin networks. And this is very well understood by mathematicians in the Euclidean case. In the Euclidean case, the Ashtekar connection is purely real. It's purely SU2 real connection. And in particular, this is related, and this is one of the most beautiful results in my lifetime in mathematical physics, and it's Ed Witten's connection. It was a conjecture of Atiyah and demonstrated by Witten using beautiful methods of conformal field theory, that this is not just a knot invariant, an invariant of how that graph is knotted and linked up, but a fundamentally interesting non-invariant, namely the Jones polynomial, or is sometimes called the Kaufman fractal. Now, as it stands, it's not defined. There's a singularity in if you try to compute it along the edges of the networks. And that's because it needs to be regularized and get framing information. So it has information which has to do with rotations of the edges of a ribbon as if the edges of the graph that you're computing the holonomy on became ribbons and could be twisted as well as knotted and braided. So you require an extension of loop quantum gravity where the graphs are all extended by being framed. And when you're done working that out, you're in the category of SU2 quantum group, SU2 quantum group at a root of unity, where the level of the corresponding conformal field theory is inversely related to the cosmological constant. And again, there's that inversely related to the cosmological constant. And this, again, is very suggestive and has not been developed as much as I believe it might be. The relationship between knot theory, algebra, conformal field theory, all that beautiful mathematics having to do with quantum groups and three-dimensional topology and two-dimensional conformal field theory. This suggests should be at the core of quantum gravity. It should be at the center of everything we do in quantum gravity. And for historical reasons, it's not. Although there are some people, including some people in this room, who have been doing very interesting things in the last years of development. Okay. Here's something you can do. Once you decide that this Stern-Simons invariant is an interesting time coordinate, you can prove the thermality of quantum gravity with a positive cosmological constant. There's an old result of Malcolm Perry and Steve Hawking and I think Gary Gibbons that quantum field theory in a background of the sitter space-time is thermal and has a temperature T, which I'll get to in a minute. We can do much better and show that the whole quantum theory of gravity, not on a fixed background of the sitter, but with a positive cosmological constant, is a thermal theory and has a temperature, which is exactly the temperature that they computed in the semi-classical case. And the way you do that is you remember the KMS condition that a thermal state of a quantum system is periodic in imaginary time. If you think that the Chern-Simons invariant, and I forgot to tell you, that's complex, of course, because it's a function of the Ashtekar connection, which is complex. The time variable we're interested in is its imaginary part. If you make the continuation to the Euclidean theory, the connection is real and you don't have to take the imaginary part. And then the invariant, the integral, and let's put it on a free sphere of the Chern-Simons invariant, has an interesting property that it's not exactly gauge invariant. It's gazing right under small gaze transformations, connected to the identity. But under large gaze transformations, it changes by an integer 8 pi squared n. And if you identify a connection on the three sphere with the same connection after you've made the large gaze transformation, what you're doing is putting a circle. You're writing the configuration space, which is infinite dimensional, as some infinite dimensional minus one space times a circle. And the diameter of the circle is 8 pi squared. So this corresponds in dimensionless units to a temperature, a thermality, a temperature of 1 over 8 pi squared. You can translate back to dimensional variables. And I won't go into detail how you do that, but it's a straightforward calculation to pull up the periodicity and hence the temperature in physical units. And it's exactly on the dot the temperature that people derive with some classical methods. But again, now it's the temperature of the whole quantum theory of gravity. So this is a property, again, it's tying something physical about quantum gravity to an important property of this topological invariant, which is telling us something interesting about the topology of the space of configurations. So this tells us that this is something to take seriously. And now I'm about to take it seriously and go to the new work. I just want to point out something, which is that in the homogeneous case, since I'm going to be reducing and talking about homogeneous solutions at the end of the talk, if you write out what this Chern-Simons time is, it's basically the Hubble time cubed over the scale factor cubed. So it measures the number of co-moving volumes in a horizon volume. So if Chern-Simon theory time is small, the co-moving volume is within the horizon is outside the co-moving volume. And if it's large, it's the opposite case. And so in the present era, this Chern-Simon time is going backwards. But that shouldn't worry us. What's more interesting, as John McGuagio pointed out, is that in the standard cosmological scenario where you first have inflation, then you have power law for matter dominance, then you go into inflation again, this time appears to be cyclic. It appears to go forward sometimes and backwards sometimes as a time coordinate. And that's sort of intriguing. And it's not the subject of this talk, but with these collaborators, we're playing interesting kinds of games with cosmological scenarios that make use of that. Okay, so Stefan and I were talking, and he was talking with Zhao, and they went blah, 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 blah. I didn't understand what they were saying. And one day I woke up and I said, oh, I understand what they're saying. They want to add a term to the Einstein action. So here's the Einstein action in Palatini kind of variables. E is the frame fields. R is the curvature. It's the function of A. Here's the E wedge E wedge R term, which is the Einstein tensor. Here's the cosmological constant, E to the fourth. And they want to add a term R squared, which is parity odd, tying up the indices that way, and put the famous 1 over lambda there. And that's indeed what we want to do. So the theory I want to describe to you is that theory. So it's a simple modification. Now, Ashtekar and Balachandran and some other people have studied, of course, the natural thing to try to do if you're familiar with the way the topological terms can be added to Yang-Mills theory to get interesting effects and axions and so forth. It's natural to try to add a parity odd term like R wedge R to the Einstein action. And it's been studied by a number of people and it has interesting effects. The key thing that nobody thought of is adding that with 1 over the cosmological constant. The Plobansky form, and I'm going to be going back and forth between the better known Palatini form and the Plobansky form. The Plobansky form is where you write everything in terms of complex left-handed variables. So A and B are symmetric pairs of spinner indices that come from projecting from the Lorentz group into its left-handed chiral subgroup, subalgebra. And if you don't know the Plobansky form, the thing that I would point out to you is the beautifully simple form. Sigma is a two-form valued in SU2. R is a curvature valued in SU2. And there's this interesting term, sigma wedge sigma times phi, where phi is the spin 2 field, which is totally symmetric in spinner indices. And as I'll show you, if you don't know, that cubic action of those three terms is general relativity in the simplest known form. And we're just adding this new term to it. And if you are careful about keeping within the real part of general relativity and not going to its specification, you, of course, always have somewhere the complex conjugate that has to be. Now I'm going to employ another famous property of the Chern-Simons function, which is that d of it is exactly this quantity r with r, whose integral is a topological integral. If you have a four-manifold rather than a three-manifold, so you can express d in Chern-Simons. So let's study that theory. Well, the new term does interesting stuff. I just integrate the d by parts. And when I integrate the d on y Chern-Simons by parts, there's a boundary. Imagine that I have a four-manifold, which is a cobordism, which takes an initial three-dimensional surface where I put initial data to a final three-dimensional surface where I'm going to measure things. I then get boundary terms, which is exactly the factor up to this imaginary part. This is exactly the famous Kodama factor. And you get it for the final surface and the initial surface. But in between, you get this Chern-Simons time times the derivative of 1 over the cosmological constant. And so if you're willing to get adventurous at this point and say d of the cosmological constant, not necessarily zero, it might have derivatives, it might be a function, you've got yourself a new pair of dynamical variables. You've got a q dot, where the q is 1 over the cosmological constant, and the p is this Chern-Simons time that we've been finding such interesting use for already for 15 or 20 years. So this is the structure, this is what's new. In other words, is we're making the cosmological constant dynamical. We're giving it a conjugate momentum variable, which is this Chern-Simons time variable. Or you can turn it around and say the time is the configuration variable and the cosmological constant momentum variable. And you're also making contact with the Kodama state. And if you insist on that contact with the Kodama state, that fixes all the coefficients. So there's no freedom play here. I should mention in unimodular gravity, and this is something that Raphael, who is sitting way in the back, Sorkin, used in arguments about the fluctuating cosmological constant, arguing for a small value of the cosmological constant, you get a kind of Poisson bracket relationship between the volume of space-time and the cosmological constant. So this is in that spirit. And I think in some approximations it may go over. That's something we can talk about. So again, we're considering this action. I'm just emphasizing that there are no free parameters because we want to match the exponential of the Kodama state to recover the semi-classical physics of space-time with a positive cosmological constant. Here's how the dynamics works. And this, if you don't already know the Plobansky theory, this will also serve as a little tutorial of the Plobansky theory. We have three variables, the sigma, which is a two-form, the phi ABCD, which is a spin-2 field. It has 5 degrees of freedom. It's symmetric in the phis, and the connection A. We first take the equations of motion from varying the action by the phi, and we get this relationship. It's basically the sigma wedge sigma with the sin 2 par projected is zero. The sin 2 par of sigma wedge sigma is zero. And it turns out that that has a beautiful interpretation. One can show if and only if that implies there's a frame field, such that sigma is the self-dual two form of the frame field. That is, it's the frame field wedge itself projected into the left-handed part of the Lorentz group. If we vary by the sigma, we get the Einstein equations. R is equal to sigma, which is now E wedge G times the cosmological constant, plus this phi times E wedge G. And this phi then is really code for the Weyl tensor. That's where the gravitons live. That's where the gravitational degrees of freedom are. And it's cleanly separated from the other degrees of freedom, which are constrained by the analog of Gauss's law, which carry the gravitational force. But then let's do the last field equation and vary by the Ashtekar connection. And that gives you, that comes from F wedge sigma. You vary the A, there's a derivative on the variation of A that has to be integrated by parts. That gives you the derivative, covariant derivative on the sigma. And that would usually be all there was, and that would be zero, and that turns out to tell you that the torsion is zero. So that tells you that the connection is actually the space-time connection of Christoffel. But we've got another term. We've got the R wedge R term, and from varying the R wedge R term, we get something on the right-hand side. So we get an equation that says that the torsion is very closely related to D of the cosmological constant wedge the curvature tensor. That's the torsion. Torsion has many different faces. That's the torsion when it's a free form. So we have if we allow ourselves to play the game where the cosmological constant can vary, we have torsion. And we have this particularly interesting form of torsion. Okay, let's see what else we can learn. Well, there's actually an intriguing structure here, because let's look at this action in the Blavatsky. And you can say this in a more complicated way in other forms, but I use Blavatsky because it's so simple. It's got a sigma wedge sigma. Remember, secretly, sigma is E wedge G, left-handed part. It's got an R wedge R, and it's got a sigma wedge R. So this has a formal inversion or duality, where you can trade the R for sigma and the sigma for R, making the units work out using the cosmological constant. And this duality transformation controls a lot of the dynamics of the gravitational field. There are fixed points. And the fixed points are, of course, the self-dual solutions I mentioned several slides back, where the curvature is related to lambda over 3 times the frame fields. And there are no gravitons, so the Weyl tensor is zero. And this is, again, just a fancy way of writing de Sitter or anti-de Sitter if your cosmological constant is negative. By the way, I have no idea why the enormous number of people who have worked with anti-de Sitter have never tried to apply these techniques to any of the magic of anti-de Sitter stuff. But anyway, let's see what else we can do with it. So now there's a surprise. And maybe somebody will raise their hand and say, that's wrong because of this. And I would be very grateful, because it took me about a month to believe the result that we were getting. And I had to show it to a lot of people. We had to find several different ways to derive it. But the surprise is that everything I've said the last several slides is true, even if lambda is a function. That is, if the curvature is lambda over 3 times the self-dual two form, even if lambda is a function, that still is a solution to the, not the Einstein equations, but the extension of the Einstein equations that I wrote down. So we can talk, and this is not gauge. The first thought you have, or the 15th thought, is that this is gauge, but it's not gauge because the torsion is not zero and the torsion is a tensor. So you can't gauge it away by a different motion or a gauge transformation. So it seems like just by adding that almost topological term, we've greatly extended the kind of solutions that we can consider that have something like a cosmological constant to a class of solutions where the cosmological constant has dynamics and is a function. Yeah.
So this is all done for vacuum. Do you maintain any of this symmetry, the duality of when you have matter present?
We don't know. That's the honest answer. Why don't you ask me that at the end? And now, let me convince you of that. Here's a beautiful construction of self-dual solutions by Capovidal and Jacobson. And again, this is, in Lorentzian case, this is just de Sitter or anti-de Sitter. But in the Euclidean case, this uncovers a whole space of gravitational instantons. Their advice to us is to pick an SE2 connection such that its curvature satisfies this interesting equation that F wedge F, A and B are spinner indices, two components spinner indices. So I'm taking the totally symmetric part, which means I'm projecting out the spin 2 part, is zero. Find yourself a connection that satisfies that. Then pick a constant, lambda, and multiply the curvature of that connection by 3 over lambda and get a 2-form sigma. That, by construction, satisfies sigma wedge sigma equals 0, spin 2 part, and derivative of sigma equals 0. Covariant curl of sigma is 0, i.e. the torsion vanishes. So there exists a frame field, as I said, such that sigma is E wedge E, and the Einstein equations are satisfied. So that's a kind of cute construction. Where it becomes really interesting is if you repeat it, but you let lambda be a variable. If you repeat it and let lambda be a variable, when you take d of sigma, that's equal to d of 3 over lambda times f. So there's d of f, of course, is 0, covariant d of f is 0. But there's an extra term, which is related to d of lambda wedge f. And for this class of solutions, that's related to d of lambda wedge sigma. And that is the solutions that I've been telling you about, which are self-dual solutions like de Sitter, but with a variable cosmological constant. So that's an explicit construction of them. If you don't believe that, you can check it explicitly in Palatini. And I won't go through the equation, but everybody's used to the cataclysm that the cosmological constant can't vary in time because you take the Einstein equations, take the covariant divergence of the Einstein equations, everything vanishes except the derivative of the cosmological constant, which then has to be zero, so the cosmological constant has to be constant. If you follow that same procedure, but remember that there's a non-zero torsion, which has the form that I've given it, related to the derivative of the cosmological constant, that torsion cancels exactly the derivative of the cosmological constant that's hanging out there, and you get consistency. And you have to take, to really convince yourself, you have to take a second covariant curl of the Einstein equations, and you generate some terms which, given the self-dual conditions, that you satisfy them. Yes, Rafa?
At this point, can we choose lambda to be any function we like on the manifold?
Yes. But I'm going to show you that that's limited in a minute. But up to this point, It seems. Let me not say yes. Let me say it seems so. And show you the next step. Okay, well, there are now two technical transparencies on torsion. And the point is, torsion has a one-form version, a two-form version, a three-form version, a no-form version. And I need to do a little bit of playing around. And the reason I need to do a little bit of playing around is that Lorentzian connection is the usual connection, which is a function of frame fields, plus an added term. And that added term is called the contorsion. And it's related by a few pages of index manipulation from the torsion. And I had to do those few pages of index manipulation several times because there's a crucial sign in the outcome. And I got Jens Obi to, who was a Psi student here, to help out with the technicality. But in any case, when you're done, you get a value for this contorsion. And then you can remember that the curvature tensor, but here the curvature 2 form of the connection A is the ordinary one, it's the function of the Christoffel connection, plus terms in the contorsion. But the terms in the contorsion have the derivatives of the cosmological constant in it. So the result is that you get an effective theory. When you solve the equations of motion for the connection and plug in and get an effective action, that effective action is exactly of the right form to give something like a kinetic energy to the cosmological constant. There's the derivative of lambda squared, but let me point out it's not canonical, it's a 1 over lambda squared, which is very important. So now we're really giving that is when we've integrated out the field equations for the A as well as the phi as well as the sigma to get us back to the Einstein equations. We have an effective dynamics for the cosmological constant. And now we're up and running. Now this is going to be, this has been a slight change on advanced index notation, index manipulation of general relativity, but now we can do some cosmology. This is the equations of motion. There's this generalization or modification of the covariant box, which has the cosmological constant embedded in it. And that acting on lambda is the following. Sigma weg sigma is basically the volume element, it's e to the fourth. And then you have an interesting form for a force. You have the difference between 1 and f wedge f over the cosmological constant squared over the volume element. So this dynamics drives the cosmological constant to fixed points where lambda over 3 is the square root of f wedge f over the volume element. So now it's interesting. Now it's interesting. And Robert Sims has done a detail that I certainly, it's not the kind of thing that I do, but he has done a detailed numerical investigation of the solutions of this theory, and I'm going to end by telling you a little bit about that. I'll just mention that if you're a particle physicist, you know that the same quantity is the coefficient of the chiral anomaly, the anomaly in the conservation of the left-hand current. So you can use this if the theory is coupled to chiral fermions, which I didn't yet couple it to, but if you did, you could use this and you get the relationship between the fixed points of the cosmological constant and the chiral anomaly, which is related to particle production. It measures the rate of particle production of left-handed particles minus right-handed particles.
Is this quantity on the right-hand side a constant?
It's not a constant.
But you see there's a fixed point where d mu lambda is zero, something confused.
So what we see in the solutions is that the cosmological constant goes to this, but this is redshifting like 1 over a cubed at least. And so the cosmological constant gets trapped in this fixed point and then redshifts to zero. I'll show you that.
Don't get modified in the presence of matter. So
we don't know. We don't think so, but we are not. Again, this is work in progress. Andrew, we were chatting yesterday. Pointed out that there's an old mystery that G lambda is related to the mass difference among the lightest neutrinos, the fourth. And so anytime you have the chiral current, you think about neutrinos. And it's intriguing. At the moment, it's only intriguing. But as I said, we're excited about it. Now, before I tell you the numerical work, I'm just going to give a hint of another direction that we went with this, which I don't have time, because I'm just going to have 5 minutes, and I want to tell you how the cosmologies described by this theory do evolve. You can take the point of view when you're quantizing general relativity that you fix the three-dimensional slices, and then quantize the theory in a gauge where the three-dimensional slices are fixed. And if you do that, then it's natural to consider the Chern-Simon invariant of each three-dimensional slice as giving a clock, which gives a time to that three-dimensional slice. And it's interesting to posit that the cosmological constant is a function on the slice. So it's not a function of space-time, it's just a function of the slice. And if you do that, then the PQ dot term in the action is this, and it leads to a Poisson bracket, in which the Poisson bracket of the cosmological constant with its time coordinate is proportional to the cosmological constant squared itself. And that leads to a kind of uncertainty principle, where the value of the uncertainty principle is related to the cosmological constant itself. So in other words, in the early universe where the cosmological constant may be big, you can't know the cosmological constant and the time at the same time. And remember, this time is telling you basically what your situation is with respect to how many Hubble horizons the co-moving horizon fits into. So the two things that you need to do early universe classical cosmology, what's the vacuum energy? And are you inside or outside the horizon? You can't both know. And that leads to some interesting opportunities to invent new kinds of early universe cosmological scenarios. And Zhao Mukwege and I had a paper where we begin speculating about this. It's also in the context of this, and maybe if people want in the question session, I'll come back to this. I would make the remark, it's in the context of this theory that I would make the remarks that the Chern-Simon state or the Kodama state is really the transition amplitude.
So the energy conjugate of the Chern-Simon is 1 over the constant.
Yes. Okay. Now, I almost never am the kind of scientist that displays graphs. And this is because of Robert and Stefan, who are those kind of scientists. But here is what I'm going to be showing you, evolution. So you take the theory as I've described it, do the standard Friedman-Robertson-Walker parameterization in terms of scale factor A. Then the dynamical variables are the scale factor, cosmological constant, and some matter, which we're going to represent as a perfect fluid. And the important thing the matter is going to do is contribute and I hypothesize that it contributes in some fixed way through the chiral anomaly to this term R wedge R. And so we're just going to posit that this term R wedge R redshifts by some factor. And it doesn't, as long as it redshifts away, it turns out that's not much how fast it redshifts. And then we're going to integrate. And what I want to draw your attention to, so we're going to sometimes call lambda phi when we put in Planck units, and sometimes we're going to take its log and have var phi. And sometimes we're going to take the R wedge R and put it in Planck units and call it B triddle. And the whole thing is the study of this is the potential of the cosmological constant. And I'm going to show you that potential in a minute. I'm just, oh, here is another form of that potential when we put it in Lagrangian invariants. And it's interesting for different integration, for different initial conditions to study different forms of the theory. But this is basically the theory we're studying. Either this potential or written in logarithmic variables, this potential. Here's what the potential looks like. This is for the cosmological constant. And this is for its log. And we see that there's for large values of B twiddle, or in other words, before this term has redshifted away, there's a clean minimum. The minimum goes towards negative log of the cosmological constant. In other words, to the cosmological constant is decreasing. And eventually goes to zero. But it never crosses zero. We don't have a theorem. But in all the simulations that those guys have done, the cosmological constant starts positive and stays positive. It starts negative and stays negative. So it doesn't misbehave across. Here's a typical thing that can happen. This is the cosmological constant on the right. And you see they set an initial condition of twice the fixed point. And then as the fixed point goes into the origin, cosmological constant follows it. You're doing some damped oscillations, but never crossing zero. That's a typical behavior. So in other words, this is a mechanism to damp away the cosmological constant by tying it to a matter of. Yeah.
Can I ask, why is it that you're assuming a form for R, R tilde, rather than self-consistently deriving that from the solution? Doesn't the solution itself determine what R, R tilde is?
Yes, but that we're not doing that because we believe that the R tilde is driven by the anomaly, by the matter degrees of freedom, and we're not modeling that. We would love to do what you suggest, but we're not.
Okay.
What are the time scales for both the oscillations and the damping?
Planck scale.
They're all Planck scale.
No, the time scales are units of Hubble times informal time, the units of Hubble.
So these oscillations are still happening now, or still
just? It depends on the initial conditions. Again, this is work in progress.
Okay.
All this numerical work is the last 5 or 6 days, I should say. So this is very much work in progress, but this is the kind of thing we're seeing. Let me show you just two other results, and then I'll be done. I don't want to close on people's time. Here, we just make explicit the coupled evolution for rho dot, where rho is a perfect fluid. A dot over A, that's standard, and lambda double dot. We take the initial condition for lambda at twice the fixed point. And we can look at different graphs. Where is my... in the upper left, this is the cosmological constant in units of its initial value. And it fluctuates and then gets trapped and goes to zero. Here is rho lambda over rho matter. And so in this solution, the rho lambda is dominating. You can see that the A of T goes exponential. This would be a power law behavior. So this is a solution where the cosmological constant is not getting trapped. It's freezing out. And the cosmology becomes lambda dominated. We then looked at a bunch of those like that where we varied the initial conditions. We vary particularly the initial H naught, and I apologize to the cosmologists in the audience for calling an initial value of Hubble's parameter H naught. But I'm not a cosmologist. Just from that. That turns out to essentially influence the parameter C pseudo, the value of H initial, which comes right here and tells you how important is the potential for the cosmological constant. So we set initial conditions always at twice the fixed point for the cosmological constant. We play with the initial H, and we fix from the constraint equation, the Feynman equation, the fluid density. And we get a range of solutions. This is lambda, and we see we have four small values of the potential. I believe lambda is enslaved by the matter and red shifts away. But there are solutions where lambda dominates and it becomes a de Sitter universe. This is the H in units of the H naught, and again you see that we have domination of lambda and the sitting universe in some initial conditions and redshift away of lambda of the vacuum energy for other initial conditions. And this is A of C, and again it stays power law, or when it becomes lambda dominated, it goes exponential. And this is rho lambda over rho matter. And we can tell the similar story. Okay. So, thank you very much. I'll leave you with the behavior that we've been observing, and thank you very much for your interest. I don't know that it's different from that. But what we're interested in is that we don't have any choices. That is, if we want to make contact with the first part of the story I told you, where the Kodama state is playing a role, then we have to fix the parameter and the coefficient in front. We have to fix the lambda to be 1 over lambda, becoming like 1 over lambda, with a fixed coefficient. And we therefore only have choices of initial conditions when we work out the consequences. So that feels more interesting than what would be the 549th time to invent a set of scalar fields. Choose the dynamics as you will. Yeah?
In this way of looking at general relativity as a topological theory, is there a reason to treat the cosmological constant not as a constant and leaving Newton's constant like that? Or why don't you allow Newton's constant to vary?
Well, So I have written a paper in which Newton's constant and lambda do both vary at the conjugate to each other. So I've been playing this game several different. And in the paper with Zhao, we also considered that Newton's constant might be an operator or degree of freedom. So I think it's interesting to play all these things. In the relationship to topological field theory, the relationship of lambda, the cosmological constant, to the quantum deformation of the representation theory that goes into the quantum states of the gravitational field is something that's unique for the cosmological constant. And this raises the question of can that vary? And I know that some people here are thinking whether the level of the conformal field theory that lies at the heart of the quantum group can vary. And I've warned people about that.
So your effective potential for lambda or for the field phi does indeed resemble potentials which in cosmology are known to be the tracking or scaling potentials. They just follow the dominant energy density. And my question is, if you have these simulations starting, you test for various points at which to start off to set initial conditions. So it looks like you're setting the matter-dominated theorem. So far, far away, that's the matter. It would be interesting to see if you can also set the initial conditions in the radiation era to see how the background evolves, if you can still track it. So robustness to initial conditions would be good to test.
That sounds like good advice. I'll take that.
What happens if you integrate it out of lambda instead of the R equivalent? Did you mention this sometimes?
Integrate out lambda first?
Where is that equivalent?
I did think about that. I wasn't able to make sense of going in that way.
Because I'm just wondering if this is. Kind of, if you have this quantum physics equation, some kind of time variable and an energy, ideally you want some deparametrization and kind of things. You want to keep time eigenstates.
Let's talk about it. We played a. I'm not showing all the work by a long way. We played over the last 6 months with a lot of different games and variations of this. Some of which went in the paper with Zhao and myself, and many of which we didn't understand well enough to expose.
If you look at the experimental data, like choice of state W is close to minus 1.
Yes.
There's no evidence there's any time dependence on W.
Yes, I know that. And we've been talking with Andrew, and he's been emphasizing that that's a high bar.
So how can you test this?
We're very interested in testing this. I think the cosmologists are in a much, I'm not in a position to. There's a whole toolkit and literature on how you test theories like this. I finally do something in quantum gravity that goes into an area where there's a rich literature for how to test it. So I'm very happy to listen as people who are experts on how to test.
The problem is there's an extreme dearth of quantum gravity data that isn't really.
Right. So this is all classical, except the use of the chiral anomaly, which is semi-classical. I emphasized that at the beginning. This is using the cosmological constant, but we're not, in the work that I presented, we're not studying a quantum system, we're not quantizing the system. In work that I didn't present, like in the paper with Zhao, we do speculate on making the cosmological constant and the transcendent time into operators. And then we play algebraically with those operators and we try to do some interesting stuff. But in the work that I presented, it's all constant.
Can I go back to my earlier question? The first part, the self-dual geometry that was no matter, and at the end of the modeling, you've got a matter introduced there. You said you had thoughts on that. You didn't know whether you could preserve that symmetry well in this matter.
The interesting problem, and it's a solved problem, is how do you talk about matter degrees of freedom when what you've got, what the theory gives you, is an SU2 connection, like a chiral left-hand SU2 connection, a spin-2 object, and a self-dual spin-2 field, which is the self-dual 2-point. So it turns out that there's a particular density weight version of the metric of space time, which is cubic in the sigma. That is a relation which was not well known, but one can take the sigmas, cube them, and write down the metric of space time by projecting out some components of that. So by making use of that trick, one can write matter Lagrangians. In other words, you might think you can't get anywhere because the frame field and the metric are implicit in the solutions of the theory, and therefore you can't write expressions for matter degrees of freedom. But you can, using those tricks, like making a metric out of things with a cubic and a sigma. So we do know how to write all the standard matter fields. I've only thought for like 5 minutes as to whether there was anything. Clearly, their functions are the sigmas. They're not duality invariant. Because we could invent couplings of the Fs. If the sigmas couple to some Fermi field, some spin 1/2, say, neutrino field, we could invent the couplings that would make itself dual, which would be cubic couplings of the curvature tensor to currents made from the neutrino field. And I just go yelling and screaming. I don't want to follow blindly my nose and end up making things that are ugly.
It strikes me that it's a pretty big leap between there and working with the perfect fluid in cosmology. So it's just wondering how solid this numerical work is, how solidly related it is to the earlier part of your talk.
Well, this is the question that Andrew raised before. We haven't explicitly put in the matter of degrees of freedom and put in the mechanism that makes the our dual function of the matter of degrees of freedom and therefore the redshift away like some power.
I have a question going back to the, if you take the point of view of effectivity theory of the actions, so there's the sigma wedge R term, there's the volume term, which is not that, and then there's a Pontryagin class term, the R wedge R. So at the level of effectivity theory, the coefficient of the volume term and the coefficient of the Pontryagin class are independent, defined coefficients. So in your case, you select them to be one is the inverse of the other.
Yeah.
And so the question is, usually, this is kind of accidental, unless there's a symmetry protected, and usually such fixing of low energy parameter in an effective actions are not anything which are fixed. I mean, you have a fine tuning problem, or do you have a fine tuning? Or is there a deeper kind of symmetry that justifies that choice?
What justifies the choice is when there's an initial boundary and a final boundary, pulling out the right factor for the Hamilton-Jacobi function.
Now, I understand, but is there, what about the fine-tuning issues? Because you put to when you fold your RG, like, is there something that protects that choice?
I don't know.
Way?
I don't know. That's an excellent question.
I have a related question. So if you put your mechanism with the axiom, and if you thought of the contrarian term now, as the axiom of the case that engaged you and you say, well, what is the common effect? So all of this, and you say, well, I observed that your field finds a dynamics where it's such that find that it is out of small ideas, and that RP that's natural. So do you think that this is like a gravitational axiom, essentially, as well?
We certainly have those thoughts, and people have certainly tried to mimic the Petchikin mechanism with F wedge. So we have thoughts, but we don't have, if I had a result about that, I'd present it.
I think this is a good chance to close the seminar. Leave will be around to ask more questions, and let's thank you again for listening to this talk.
Okay, thank you very much.